Good evening, listeners and students of Hitler's Table Talk, the dinner table conversation of the German leader taken down in shorthand by trusted aide, attorney Heinrich Heim, under the direction of Martin Bormann, from 1941 to 1944. Tonight is June 26, 2014. Your hosts are me, Carolyn Jaeger.
And me, Ray Goodwin.
And we're bringing you episode 16 tonight, which corresponds to December 14th through December 30th, 1941, if we can get that far. Right, Ray?
Right.
Okay, well, we think we can. So this is a pretty interesting part of the book, and it's the very end of December 1941, the last 15 days or so. There's a lot going on in the war, but Hitler is not talking about that in his dinner conversation. He's doing, as Ray put it, talking about a number of personalities tonight. And it's going to be interesting for some of you, a lot of you, to hear about these personalities. So why don't you just get started, Ray, because we've got quite a bit to cover.
Okay, 17th, December 1941, evening. Special guests, Dr. Goebbels and Himmler. There was a man in Vienna before the First World War who was always in favor of an understanding with anti-Semitic Romania, and he saw in it the best way of preventing Hungary from acquiring too much importance. That was Luger. Luger was also of the opinion that it was possible to maintain the Austrian state, but on condition that Vienna regained all its supremacy. Schonerer, on the other hand, took as his point of departure the idea that the Austrian state ought to disappear. His attitude toward the House of Habsburg was brutally radical. From that time dates the first attempt to oppose the Germanic racial community to the monarchy. On that point, Luger and Schonerer parted company. Luger, who had belonged to the Pan-Germanist movement, went over to the Christian Social Party, for he thought that anti-Semitism was the only means of saving the state. Now, in Vienna, anti-Semitism could never have any foundation but a religious one. From the point of view of race, about 50% of the population of Vienna was not German. The number of Jews amongst 1,800,000 inhabitants was close to 300,000. But the Czechs of Vienna were anti-Semitic. Luger succeeded in filling 36 of the 148 seats of the Vienna Municipal Council with anti-Semites. When I arrived in Vienna, I was a fanatical opponent of Luger. As a pan-German and as a supporter of Schonerer, I was accordingly an enemy of the Christian socials. Yet in the course of my stay in Vienna, I couldn't help acquiring a feeling of great respect for Luger personally. It was at the City Hall that I first heard him speak. I had to wage a battle with myself on that occasion, for I was filled with the resolve to detest Luger, and I couldn't refrain from admiring him. He was an extraordinary orator. It's certain that German policy would have followed another direction if Luger hadn't died before the First World War as a result of blood poisoning, after having been blind for the last years of his life. The Christian socials were in power in Vienna until a collapse in 1918. Luger had royal habits. When he held a festivity in the City Hall, it was magnificent. I never saw him in the streets of Vienna without everybody stopping to greet him. His popularity was immense. At his funeral, 200,000 Viennese followed him to the cemetery. The procession lasted a whole day.
Wow.
Luger was the greatest mayor we ever had. If our commons acquired a certain autonomy, that was thanks to him. What in other cities was the responsibility of private firms, he converted in Vienna into public services. Thus, he was able to expand and beautify the city without imposing new taxes. The Jewish bankers one day hit on the idea of cutting off his sources of credit. He founded the Municipal Savings Bank, and the Jews at once knuckled under, overwhelming him with offers of money. Schonerer and Luger remained opponents until the end, but they were both great Germans. In their dealings with the House of Habsburg, they both had the habit of behaving as one great power treating with another. Schonerer was the more logical of the two, for he was determined to blow up the Austrian state. Luger, on the other hand, believed that it was possible to preserve this state within the German community. A city like Hamburg is supremely well-governed. The lowest point was reached in Leipzig at the time when Kreisleiter Donicke was mayor there. He was an excellent Kreisleiter, but a mere cipher as a mayor. I have several original scores of Richard Wagner, which was something that not even Donicke could overlook. The result was that one day in the course of a ceremony, to the accompaniment of speeches in Saxon dialect, I received from Donicke's innocent hands a lithographed score of Wagner, which he quite simply confused with a manuscript. Donicke was beaming with satisfaction. The following is approximately the opening of the speech he made before the whole assembled university. In Leipzig was born the celebrated composer Richard Wagner, author, amongst others, of the opera Tannhäuser. The professors looked at one another in embarrassment. I myself was looking for a trapdoor through which I might disappear. As I left, I said to Mutschmann, "Let me know within a week the name of your new mayor."
Well, I think I'll start commenting a little bit here because keeps going on. Now, this part about the Wagner score, I really didn't understand, and I still don't. I can't figure out what was wrong, because he was the author of Tannhäuser, and he was born in Leipzig, so I don't know what was... did you get any clue as to what he's talking about?
Well, I felt like it was directly what he was holding in his hands there. He had that lithograph score of Wagner, which he simply confused with a manuscript, and he was holding a musical thing that Wagner had written, and he was thinking it was the opera Tannhäuser. That's what I thought it was.
Well, something like that, I guess. But
yeah,
it was
a social gaffe, no doubt.
Yeah. But this Luger and Schonerer, they were quite a couple of characters, and they were both big anti-Semites. But they had different ideas about how they wanted to handle the German-Austrian question. They were both pro-German, and Schonerer was something of a nobleman, not going way back, but somehow his father got some kind of got the count title for doing something, and he lived in a big castle-like place. But still, he became more and more, and he started out, you know, liberal, but he got more and more populist. And he got more for the working man and so on. But at the same time, he got more and more anti-Semitic. He got so anti-Semitic that it finally, I guess, kind of destroyed his political career. And just at the time that he was at his high point, he then started to unravel, and his career went to hell, and he got out of the public life. Luger was not as extreme as Schonerer. But he hung in there, and so as Hitler's saying, he was a wonderful mayor. I guess he did a lot of good things for the city of Vienna, and always did the right thing. So Hitler started out, though, as to be a big fan of Schonerer.
I think the point of departure there was he and Schonerer felt the same regarding the ruling House of Habsburg. That both felt it was corrupt and was not good for Germany.
Yeah, right. And of course, now here's where this anti-Slavism comes in. Mm-hmm. This goes back, and it didn't start with Hitler. There was a lot of competition or animosity or differences between the Slavs in the Austro-Hungarian Empire and the Germans. And I talked about this with Willie Chrisman quite a bit. He grew up in it. His father was involved in it. And it was that there was always there was a pan-Slavism, and they wanted more and more influence, and the Germans were holding on, and they wanted the language of the empire to be German, the official language, not anything Slavic. And this was going on, and both these men were involved in that. I don't know if you'd call it anti-Slavism. It's more like pro-Germanism. And then, of course, the Slavs were pro-Slav, so that's just natural. Mm-hmm. And this goes way back. And there was a lot of that, of course, in Austria, because it was, as he said, what was that number? Half and half or something like that, the mm-hmm. population.
Yeah, 50%.
Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. So it was interesting to hear him comment on that. He's pretty much into that, the contest between those two men when he was living there, and had his strong opinions, naturally. Hitler always had strong opinions on things.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, that's all I wanted to say about that.
Okay, and as we go along here, what Hitler is referencing a lot here are works of art. Anyway, he says, our best municipal administrator is, beyond all doubt, Fehler. But Liebel is a personality. He doesn't yet know that I found the goblet by Jamnitzer for him. He supposes it's still at the Hermitage. The Jews had sold it, and I bought it back.
Yeah, now the Hermitage is the big museum in Moscow, I think or St. Petersburg, probably. That's right. The best museum, art museum in Russia. Mm-hmm. And so that's what he's talking about there. I'm not familiar with the goblet by Jamnitzer, but it had to have been very, very valuable, and it's all capitalized.
Right, right. He said, the Jews had sold it, and I bought it back in Holland at the same time as the objects of the Mannheimer collection. The Festival of the Rosary by Albrecht Dürer is still in Prague. So, Liebel never misses an opportunity of reminding me that he possesses the frame of this picture. Very well, I said to him on the last occasion, we'll have a copy made.
Now, that's supposed to be funny, I'm sure.
Yeah.
That's supposed to be a joke.
Right.
Or whatever, he's got the frame, so...
we'll make a copy of it. Yeah. Every time something turns up in the Prague neighborhood, I receive more or less veiled allusions from Nuremberg to the fact that it would perhaps be appropriate to remove such and such or such and such a work to a place of safety. Krakow had scarcely fallen when Liebel had already succeeded by some wangle, without anybody's noticing, in having the sculptures of Veit Stoss taken down from their pedestals and repatriated to Nuremberg. Liebel regards the inhabitants of Furth as parasites. He has discovered numerous arguments proving that they've cheated the city of Nuremberg. If it depended on him, the city of Furth would be exterminated. For lack of that, he would be contented with annexing it.
You know, speaking of Veit Stoss, who I think is so great, and I saw a lot of his work when I was in Germany. I didn't even see what he had in Poland. I didn't get into that place where they have some of the stuff in the church. But it's interesting that this Liebel was so pro-German and so, you know, for his own people that he's aware of all these things. And when he had the opportunity in Krakow, he says, well, he managed to somehow get in there and have somebody take all those sculptures down and take them to Nuremberg into the salt mines, you know, for safety,
mm-hmm.
and so on. And I do believe that a lot of what I saw of Veit Stoss was in Nuremberg, yeah.
Mm-hmm. An excellent mayor was Siebert at Rothenburg and Lindau. Siebert is a personality of the first order. He's a counterweight to Wagner, who, for his part, has more gifts for propaganda. Siebert, what's more, has a feeling for the arts. It's to him especially that we owe the restoration of the keep at Nuremberg. Liebel let him do it without saying a word, and then when the work was finished, he suggested to Siebert that the keep should be offered to the Führer. But Liebel knew very well that I'd never accept such a gift. So Siebert came and solemnly offered me the keep. Next day, it was Liebel who came to tell me how glad he was to learn that I'd accepted. You're mistaken, I said. I do not accept this gift. Liebel thereupon asked me whether he could beg of me the favor of returning the keep to him on behalf of the ancient and noble city of Nuremberg. Siebert came to see me again, but this time to weep on my bosom. He complained with some justice of Liebel's not very regular proceedings. After all, it was he, Siebert, who had provided all the money. If I'm not mistaken, the matter was settled in such a way that Nuremberg finally got the keep. The mayor...
You know, I can't figure out what the keep is. I don't know what the keep is.
You know, I looked in the dictionary for that, Carolyn, and, of course, the word keep has so many, many varied usages and all, uh-huh. But I finally found it as a noun, and it was some sort of monument. And so that's, you know...
It's a monument at Nuremberg.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And it's some sort of a work of art, whether it's a sculpture or what, but as a noun... It was some sort of work of art that the dictionary said, for example, a monument. So,
guess they know what they're referring to, but the rest of us sure don't know by just using the word keep.
That's right.
And it's not even capitalized. It's small letters.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you for that. Good for
sure.
You.
The mayor of Regensburg is also excellent. He's our greatest builder of cities for workers.
Okay, that is Regensburg.
Regensburg? Okay.
Yeah.
I'm always disappointed when I observe that certain cities that have great pasts are not governed by first-rate administrators. The authority is vested in the Reich, but the administration should be decentralized. Otherwise, what we'd have would be the reign of state officials, and the talents budding on the spot would be systematically ignored. And that closes out that section, I think, on an excellent note there. Once again, he's talking about you don't need the entire nation governed out of Berlin or even an area governed out of one city. And he's talking about the value of local leadership.
Yeah. Yeah, he brings that up quite often, so obviously mm-hmm. that's something he wants people to use their initiative. He goes into that too later, and that's
right.
A part of that. You know, you're not people.
Yeah.
He hates the German way that he thinks that the Germans are much too prone to want to have rules for everything, and then they don't have to think, and they won't be wrong because they'll just follow the rule. And he doesn't like that. He doesn't want to encourage that.
He always makes it a point to link initiative with responsibility, and he says that's what holds so many people back is they don't want any responsibility.
Yeah.
Therefore, they take less initiative or no initiative at all, and just say, okay, let's go by the rule book.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. That's no. There's no doubt that was big in his thinking.
Right. Okay. Shall we go to the next set?
Yeah.
The night of 17th, 18th, December, 1941, special guest, Dr. Goebbels. I was faced with that question when we first took power. Should we preserve the Christian chronology, or should we inaugurate a new era? I reasoned that the year 1933 merely renewed our link with the military tradition. At that time, the notion of the Reich had been, so to speak, lost. But it has again imposed itself on us and on the world. When one speaks of Germany, wherever one may be, one no longer says anything but the Reich.
You know, that was there were people in the party who thought that when Hitler took power, you probably know this, and some people would know it, that they said we should start at year one because we're in a whole new thing, you know, a whole new era, and they wanted not to just follow along with the calendar, but they Hitler, I guess, and maybe a few other thought that was maybe too drastic.
Sure.
I wonder what that would have been. That wouldn't have fit in, you know, with the rest of the world. It's like the Jews do with their having their own.
Mm-hmm. Oh, exactly, calendar. That would have entailed so much changing of this, that, and the other.
Yeah.
And it was so much simpler just to refer to Greater Germany as the Reich. Unification.
It follows the Third Reich.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay.
The army of the Reich must gradually be steeped in the old traditions, especially those of Prussia, Bavaria, and Austria. It's regrettable that we have not yet arrived at a uniform style for the eagles and standards of our various arms. What a fine thing it is, the war flag of the Reich. But it's used only by the Navy. Raeder knew that. He knew that when a ship hoists its colors, it's hoisting the colors of the nation. Frisch, on the other hand, wanted to give the Army an independent personality, and that's why our regimental flags are, in a sense, the flags of an association. They emphasize whatever personifies each particular arm, whereas what should be accented is whatever recalls that they belong to the Reich. The Crusaders, in their struggle against the Saracens, all fought under the emblem of Christendom. The Romans also all had the same standard.
Okay, well, that was short and
yeah,
sweet.
But you know one comment I have on that? The first time I saw that, and I always thought it was just it was the naval battle flag. I thought that was the most beautiful flag there ever was, and it should have been symbolic of all Germany, just like he says here, all of them, because I really consider that the prettiest flag of the Third Reich.
What does it look like?
It's not just the red with the swastika in the center, the black swastika with the white. It has a black, for lack of a better word, Maltese cross emanating from all four, from noon, 3, 6, and 9 of the clock where the swastika is in the center. Mm. It has black going out each of those directions. And as I recall, there is an eagle, a smaller eagle on it, but it's just absolutely a beautiful flag.
Mm. Okay.
So I agreed with him on that.
yeah. Well, he seems to be usually right, doesn't he?
Yes, he does.
Before we go on to the next, that was, what did you say, the 17th?
That's correct.
Okay. Well, on the 16th, the German offensive around Moscow came to a complete halt, and maybe that's why he's not saying so much, because he's got a lot going on here to handle. And on the 17th, the Battle of Sevastopol begins. Place has been in the news a lot lately, so everybody should know where that is in the Crimea, and that turned out successful. So things are still being successful. Of course, we're just in December 41. And also on the 18th, the Japanese troops landed on Hong Kong Island. Japanese were doing well, too. So that's that.
Right.
So is this the 18th of December next?
That is correct.
Okay, I've got that.
All right. 18th of December 1941, noon, special guest, Himmler.
Himmler's been there a lot. He doesn't seem to leave. So I guess there's a lot to talk to him about. Doesn't necessarily go with these things that are happening, though.
Hitler says, "What is happening in the Far East is happening by no will of mine. For years, I never stopped telling all the English I met that they would lose the Far East if they entered into a war in Europe. They didn't answer, but they assumed a superior air. They're masters in the art of being arrogant."
I love that.
I do too.
You know, he admired the English. He liked them. He wanted to be friends with them, but he certainly didn't miss out how they could treat him too, and treat Germans, and how arrogant they could be. You know, mm-hmm. They can. That's true too.
And he says here, "I was moved when," is it Mussert, Carolyn?
I guess.
Yeah, that's how I would look at it. Mussert said to me, "You will surely understand me at this hour. 3 centuries of effort are going up in smoke." Himmler intervened. "We must consider this much compensation that in this way the Dutch people will maintain its integrity, whereas before it was running the risk of corrupting itself with Malayan blood."
Well, I was happy to see something from Himmler there.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the reason that the person taking these notes doesn't record what others say, unless it's something that Hitler is responding to, in a sense, is because there is instruction is to take down Hitler's
mm-hmm.
words, and that's it. But it's nice to hear what somebody else is saying.
I agree.
Once in a while. So and Himmler is bringing up the racial, the racial blood here.
Sure.
His thing.
The Japanese are occupying all the islands, one after the other.
Yeah, now this is Hitler again.
Yeah. They will get hold of Australia, too. The white race will disappear from those regions. This development began in 1914, at the moment when the European powers authorized Japan to lay her hands on Kiachau. And that's the end of that little short section.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought that was interesting that he used the words the white race, or it was translated that way.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
First time I've seen that from Hitler, the white race. He usually calls it something else. Seems like it, because that just strikes me as like I've never seen that before.
Right.
And then this Kiachau thing, where it does say here 1914, it was World War One. It was Kiachau, or however it's pronounced, Kiachau Bay, was a German colonial concession from 1898 until 1914. Somehow they lost it then,
mm-hmm.
had to give it up or whatever.
Yeah. I like that very first statement where he takes a slap at the British telling, you know, he said, I never stopped telling all the English I met they would lose the Far East if they entered into a war in Europe. And, of course, the British didn't answer but assumed a superior air. And then this Mussert said to him, confirming exactly what he'd said, hey, you'll understand me at this hour, 3 centuries of effort are going up in smoke. And, of course, he means the 3 centuries of building up that British Empire were collapsing in smoke.
Yeah, I wonder who Mussert was.
Yeah, that's that crossed my mind.
I didn't even think to look him up. That just kind of passed me by.
Yeah.
Okay, well, now we're coming up to the night of the 23rd and 24th. Is that right?
That is correct.
Okay, so I checked out the timeline. I thought I'd mention a few things that had been taking place in between these two sections. And starting with December 19th, Hitler becomes Supreme Commander-in-Chief of the German Army. So this is when the United States had come into the war. There's a larger war, and when Hitler decided that he needed to take over and be the actual commander-in-chief, and he had to okay all the decisions and so on, and nobody could do anything without his okay of the generals and field marshals and all that, the Wehrmacht. Then December 21st, the siege of Leningrad continues, and it's estimated, you know, of course, they're always in the timeline I use at Wikipedia, they always make out everything real bad for the Allied side, or they're taking all this suffering and blah blah. You never hear anything that's happening to the Germans. They never talk about the German cities being bombed or anything like that. Mm-hmm. But they say that 3,000. It's estimated that 3,000 are dying each day of starvation and disease in Leningrad because of the siege. So that's going on, and we're now at the 23rd and 24th. Christmas time, but I don't think we hear about that.
Right, right. It occurs to me that already Lynn's museum can bear comparison with no matter which museum in New York. In the years 1890 to 1900, one could still form great collections. After that, it became practically impossible to lay one's hand on the truly great works. The Jews mounted guard and monopolized the lot. If I'd had the money sooner, I'd have been able to keep in Germany a number of works that have emigrated. It's lucky I got there finally. Otherwise, we'd have nothing left but rubbish, for the Jews do their business in works of real value.
Now, you know, Hitler was an art collector.
Mm-hmm.
And Hitler had made a lot of money on Mein Kampf already.
Mm-hmm.
Or I don't know when he's talking about here exactly, but he did. And I don't think he was spending state money for art. I don't think that's what was going on. I think he bought this. He bought art himself,
mm-hmm.
personally. I wish I knew more about that.
Yep, that is interesting.
I'll have to look that up. I'll have to try to find out more about that.
They made use of literature to achieve this.
The Jews, that is.
Yes, exactly. What we should blame is, firstly, the cowardice of our bourgeoisie, and next, the state of society, for which the bourgeoisie is equally responsible. whereby only a tiny fraction of the population is interested in art. The Jew was able to say to himself, these Germans, who accept perverse pictures of the crucified Christ, are capable of swallowing other horrors too, if one can persuade them that these horrors are beautiful. The people was not concerned in such matters. It was all the affair of the so-called elite, who believed in their own competence, whereas in reality, they were not capable of telling the difference between what was beautiful and what was ugly. This setup was useful to me at the period when, although I still hadn't much money, I began to buy. Another thing that was useful to me in England was the fact that certain works, by reason of their subjects, did not fit in with the conformist morals of society. So it was that I was able to take possession of the admirable Venus by Bardon, which formerly belonged to the Duke of Kent. I'm delighted that I succeeded in obtaining in England some works by the highest level in exchange for some horrors boosted by the Jewish critics. Those are real forgers' tactics on the Jews' part, for they're perfectly well aware of the worthiness of the works they're boosting. They've used this transvaluation of values to buy surreptitiously and at a favorable price the masterpieces that they had depreciated.
Well, he's got their number all right.
Yes, he does.
And, you know, he was so knowledgeable, not only in architecture, but in painting and sculpture, in art. It's just amazing all that he could attend himself to and learn about. And he had such terrific taste. He did. Oh, not everybody would agree, you know, with the same taste, but he certainly didn't have bad taste. When he says here that he still didn't have much money, at that time, but he began to buy art. And he means he bought that art himself.
Yes. I think so, he answered your question a bit ago. Yeah.
And the fact that he could buy Bourdon, a big painting of Venus, I think it's fairly good size. I mean, it's not gigantic or anything. You'd think it would cost a lot, but at that time, maybe sometimes people just didn't like something. Maybe Bourdon was out of favor a little bit. And that Venus, she's just a naked lady laying there, you know, naked as can be. So sometimes people maybe didn't want that in their houses. So he was able to buy it from the Duke of Kent. Mm-hmm. Maybe he got a good buy on it. But he's right about how the Jews will, there were so many of the art dealers, and they would say, well, this is not good, or this is not, we're not sure this is genuine or authentic. And they do all these tricks in order to bring the prices down. Then they'd buy it.
Yeah, and then conversely, they would promote garbage as really great works of art.
Right, and see, we know they still do that, and they do it, and they do it with everything, not just art. That's how they do everything.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing, you know, that people can't get angry at these Jews like they should. All right, well, we're going to another little section. I've got, on December 25th, Christmas Day, the Red Army and Navy amphibious forces landed Kerch, K-E-R-C-H. There was famous battles taking place there in the Crimea, and they stayed there until April. So the Germans had taken Sevastopol, and the Germans were in Crimea, but they still didn't have, the Soviets were still trying to keep it. I thought that was kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Kerch was eventually won by the Germans, and then they continued moving on.
Right.
Christmas is over now. We didn't get to hear much about Christmas.
Yeah, that's right. The night of the 28th, 29th of December, 1941. When I was a young man, the doctors used to say that a meat diet was indispensable for the formation of bones. This was not true. Unlike people who eat polenta, we have bad teeth. It occurs to me that this has something to do with a diet that's more or less rich in yeast. 9/10 of our diet are made up of foods deprived of their biological qualities. When I'm told that 50% of dogs die of cancer, there must be an explanation for that. Nature has predisposed the dog to feed on raw meat by tearing up other animals. Today, the dog feeds almost exclusively on mixed bread and cooked meat. If I offer a child the choice between a pear, and a piece of meat, he'll quickly choose the pear. That's his atavistic instinct speaking.
Well, I had to disagree with that because I agree with the dogs and so on, and dogs should be fed a raw diet. Mm-hmm. And they need animals eat the entire kill that they kill the intestines, and they get vegetables that way from these animals that graze and so on, and they they eat the head and the eyes, and all this stuff has good things in it, and the kidneys and livers and so on, but now they can't stay healthy on the kind of diet that they get. It's really too bad when you think of how all these people who love their pets harm their pets because they don't want to bother. You can't get your animal to, usually they like it right away. They eat raw meat. But it's just a little bit more troublesome. Mm-hmm. So people don't do it. And then they listen to the veterinarian who says, no, don't do that. And don't give them any bones. Well, they are chewing all those bones up too.
It's what cleans their teeth.
Yeah, and gives them a lot of good stuff too.
Right.
Anyway, I was going to say though that I don't agree with the reason for choosing the pear over the piece of meat by a child. They like the pear because it's sweet,
uh-huh.
and Hitler, because he was anti-meat for humans. He thought people should eat pears instead of meat, but that's not. I don't agree with that, as I've said before.
Right. Country folks spend 14 hours a day in the fresh air, yet by the age of 45, they're old, and the mortality amongst them is enormous. That's the result of an error in their diet. They eat only cooked foods. It's a mistake to think that man should be guided by his greed. Nature spontaneously eliminates all that has no gift for life. Man alone amongst the living creatures tries to deny those laws of nature. The great tragedy for man is that he understands the mechanism of things, but the things themselves remain an enigma to him. We are capable of distinguishing the component parts of a molecule, but when it's a question of explaining the why of a thing, words fail us. And that's what leads men to conceive of the existence of a superior power. If I have an observatory built at Linz, I'll have the following words carved on its front. The heavens proclaim the glory of the eternal. It's marvelous that this is how mankind formed the idea of God. The almighty being that made the worlds has certainly granted to each being that he should be motivated by awareness of his function. Everything in nature happens in conformity to what ought to happen. Man would certainly have gone mad if he had suddenly learnt 100,000 years ago all that we know today. The human being does not develop solely through the obligations life imposes on him, but also through the habits that make up the climate of his period.
I thought that was brilliant.
Mm-hmm. I did too. Thus, the youth of today regards as quite natural various notions that seemed revolutionary to the generation before. I've totally lost sight of the organizations of the party. When I find myself confronted by one or other of these achievements, I say to myself, by God, how that has developed. So it's not correct when I'm told, for example, it's only because of you, my Führer, that Gauleiter so-and-so has succeeded in doing that. No, it depends essentially on the men who do the job. I realize that nowadays in military matters, everything depends on the men. Without them, I could do nothing. Nowadays, certain small peoples have a greater number of capable men than the whole British Empire. How many times I've heard it said in the party that a new man should be found for such and such a post. Unfortunately, I could only reply, but by whom will you replace the present holder? I'm always ready to replace an inadequate man by another with better qualifications. In fact, whatever may be said about the bonds of loyalty, it's the quality of the man who assumes responsibilities that's finally decisive.
Now he's going to talk about Stryker.
Yes.
So I'm going to go back to
Okay.
Where he was saying that the heavens proclaim the glory of the Eternal is what he would put on the front of the observatory mm-hmm. if he built one at Linz, and talking about the almighty being that made the world has granted to each being that he should be motivated by awareness of his function. And everything happens as it ought to happen. He even said that.
Exactly.
In nature mm-hmm. though. Everything
right.
is nature. And to me, this shows, and again, very clearly, that Hitler was not a megalomaniac. He had no designs on world rulership, but was humble before the laws of nature and the universe. He always was. And
yes.
Somebody who talks like that cannot be a megalomaniac who wants to rule the world. We know that that's a big, stupid statement, but people still repeat it and it's still being said.
Yes. Now we'll start with Stryker.
Right.
Of one thing there's no doubt, that Stryker has never been replaced. Despite all his weaknesses, he's a man who has spirit. If we wish to tell the truth, we must recognize that without Julius Stryker, Nuremberg would never have been won over to National Socialism. He put himself under my orders at a time when others were hesitating to do so, and he completely conquered the city of our rallies. That's an unforgettable service. More than once, Dietrich Eckart told me that Stryker was a schoolteacher and a lunatic to boot from many points of view. He always added that one could not hope for the triumph of National Socialism without giving one's support to men like Stryker. Despite everything, Eckart was very fond of him. Stryker is reproached for his Stürmer. The truth is the opposite of what people say. He idealized the Jew. The Jew is baser, fiercer, more diabolical than Stryker depicted him. It's not a crime to speak publicly of affairs of state, for the state needs the people's approval. Of course, there are cases in which it's inopportune to speak of certain matters. Whoever is guilty of doing so is committing, as a rule, nothing worse than an offense against discipline. Frick told me once that Stryker's stock had completely slumped at Nuremberg. I went to Nuremberg to try to form an opinion. Stryker came into the room, and there was a hurricane of enthusiasm. I went once to a women's gathering. It took place at Nuremberg, and I'd been warned that Elsbeth Zander was a very serious competitor to Stryker. The meeting was held in the Hercules Hall for bicycle races. Stryker was welcomed with an indescribable enthusiasm. The oldest adherents of the party all spoke in favor of Stryker and against Elsbeth Zander. There was nothing for me to do but take my departure. It goes without saying that the organization of the GAO was very imperfect. If I take a functionary of the civil service as my criterion, the comparison is obviously not to Stryker's advantage, but I must recall that it wasn't a functionary who took Nuremberg for me in 1919. When all said, it was the Gauleiters themselves who asked me to be indulgent with Stryker. In all the circumstances, there was no comparison between the faults he committed and his recognized merits, which were brilliant. As usual, one must look for the feminine angle. Who escapes from criticism? I myself, if I disappear today, realize that a time will come in 100 years perhaps when I shall be violently attacked. History will make no exception in my favor. But what importance has that? It takes only another 100 years for these shadows to be effaced. I don't concern myself with such things. I go my way. This Stryker affair is a tragedy. At the origin of the conflict lies the hatred sworn between two women. In any case, there's just one statement I have to make, that Stryker is irreplaceable. His name is engraved in the memory of the people of Nuremberg. There's no question of his coming back, but I must do him justice. If one day I write my memoirs, I shall have to recognize that this man fought like a buffalo in our cause. The conquest of Franconia was his work.
When he says there's no question of his coming back, He means there that he won't be. There's no way he can come back. Yeah.
Yeah.
But he wants to. He still wants to be fair to him and do right by him. Yeah. Now I've got a little thing about what happened there, but I'll wait till you're done here.
No, that's okay. That's okay because I had thought of interjecting something myself there. When he talks about this feud between two women, Stryker is supposedly a committed adulterer.
Yes.
And that caused all kinds of bad karma.
Yeah, Hitler's kind of focusing on that. But, you know, there's another thing that was quite well known and quite a lot talked about, and that Goering hated Stryker.
Yes.
And he didn't hide it. But he didn't have any power to get rid of him or anything. But Stryker, knowing that, he got back at Goering by spreading untrue stories about Goering in his Sturmer, such as alleging that Goering's daughter, Edda, was conceived by artificial insemination. And he was confronted with his unconcealed adultery. So some of the people there didn't like that. And that was where Stryker went too far in his mischievous or his maliciousness to say something like that about Goering's daughter. So that's one reason that Hitler couldn't excuse him or couldn't intervene in that in Stryker's favor. He was kind of a character, you know. People complained about his magazine all the time. Goebbels also hated it, I've read often enough. But Hitler liked it and thought that the magazine, something like that, was necessary and good, and he wasn't going to stop him from doing it. And he never did stop him from putting out the magazine. Even after he was no longer a Gauleiter, he was able to continue publishing, and he remained on good terms with Hitler. Then his wife died in 1943. In 1945, he was considering committing suicide, and instead he married this Adele, his former secretary. I guess they really did like each other. And then they tried to go and hide and so on, but he got caught. And
yeah.
The whole story is sad. But I like the way Hitler thinks about Stryker. And
I do, too.
The way he treated him. I just have to approve of that altogether.
Yes.
Yeah.
Hitler says, "I have a bad conscience when I get the feeling that I've not been quite fair to somebody. When I go to Nuremberg, it's always with a feeling of bitterness. I can't help thinking that, in comparison with so many services, the reasons for Stryker's dismissal are really very slender. All that said about his alleged disease is false. Stryker had only one disease, and that was nympholepsy."
Is that womanizing?
I guess it to the extreme.
Okay.
"In one way or another, we shall have to find a solution. I cannot dream of holding a rally at Nuremberg from which the man who gave Nuremberg to the party is banished."
Yeah, because this just happened around this time.
Yeah,
it's probably Stryker, yeah.
"I can install some mediocrity in Stryker's place. He'll administer the gal perfectly as long as circumstances are normal. If a catastrophe occurs, the mediocrity will disappear. The best advice I can give to my successors is, in such a case, to be loyal. Frau Stryker is outside this business. Frau Liebel is an ambitious woman."
Now, maybe there was something with Liebel, because
yes.
He was the mayor of Nuremberg. So it wasn't between Stryker's wife and his secretary, or his, you know,
right.
had a relationship with. But this hatred between two women, now it seems like it was between Stryker's wife and the mayor's wife. The mayor, I guess, thought that Stryker was an embarrassment to the city. Well, they're just talking, you know, you're supposed to know all this, but we don't know it.
Yeah. "Probably none of us is entirely normal. Otherwise, we should spend all our days in the cafe on the corner. The Catholics, the bourgeois, everybody has accused me of being crazy because in their eyes a normal man is one who drinks 3 glasses of beer every evening. Why all this fuss? It's obviously the proof that he's mad. How many men of our party were regarded in their families as black sheep? When I examine the faults for which Stryker is blamed, I realize that no great man would pass through this sieve. Richard Wagner was attacked because he wore silk pajamas. Prodigality, insensate luxury, no knowledge of the value of money. The man's mad. As regards myself, it's enough that I could be blamed for entrusting money to all and sundry and without having any guarantee that the money was wisely invested. The man who wants to kill my dog begins by saying that it has rabies. It does not affect me at all that I myself should be judged in this fashion, but I should be ashamed if I use such criteria in passing judgment on others. All sanctions are justified when it's a question of a real offense, treason to the movement, for example, but when a man has made a mistake in good faith? Nobody has the right to photograph a man surprised in intimacy. It's too easy to make a man seem ridiculous. Let every man ask himself the question, what would he do if he had the bad luck to be photographed unawares in a delicate situation? The photos in question were taken from a house opposite. It was a disgusting way of behaving, and I've forbidden any use to be made of these photos. It's not fair to demand more of a man than he can give. Stryker has not the gifts of a great administrator. Would I have entrusted the editorship of a great newspaper to Dietrich Eckert? From the financial point of view, there'd have been a terrifying mess. One day the newspaper would have come out, the next day not. If there'd been a pig to share out, Eckert would have promised it left and right and distributed at least 24 hams. Those men are made like that, but without them it's impossible to get anything started. I haven't myself the talents of a great administrator, but I've known how to surround myself with men I needed. Dietrich Eckert could not, for example, have been the director of the National Institute of Arts and Letters. It would be like asking me to devote myself to agriculture. I'm quite incapable of it. One day I had in my hands a pile of letters from Severing.
Now, Severing was a Social Democrat and the Weimar Interior Minister.
Okay. If they'd been published, he'd have been annihilated. They were the outpourings of a draper's assistant. I said to Goebbels, we haven't the right to make use of these. Reading these letters had made Severing seem to me more sympathetic than otherwise, and perhaps that's one of the reasons why later on I didn't persecute him. In the same way, I have in the state archives photographs of Mathilde von Chemnitz. I forbid them to be published. I don't think a man should die of hunger because he's been my opponent. If he was a base opponent, then off to the concentration camp with him. But if he's not a swindler, I let him go free, and I see that he has enough to live on. That's how I have helped Noske and many others. On my return from Italy, I even increased their pensions, saying to myself, God be praised, thanks to these people, we've been rid of the aristocratic riffraff that's still ruining Italy. Barring errors on my part, their pension is at present 800 marks a month. What I couldn't allow, though, was that they should make some financial arrangement in my favor, as Severing, for example, offered to do more than once. I would seem to have bought them. In the case of one of them, I know what he has said about us. On the path toward socialism, the results surpass all we had dreamed of. Thälmann himself is very well treated in his concentration camp. He has a little house to himself.
Well, maybe I'll say right here who Thälmann is.
Okay.
He was the leader of the Communist Party of Germany during most of the Weimar period. There's still memorials to him in Berlin, in the East Park that was the Communist Part. And while heading the KPD, the Communist Party of Germany, Thälmann closely aligned the German Communists with the Soviet Communist Party. So he was one of the worst of the Communists. He wasn't just for the workers, but he was for the Soviet Union. And those who supported a more autonomous course were expelled from the party. After 1945, he and other leading communists who were murdered such as Luxembourg and Karl Liebknecht and that,
yes,
were widely honored in East Germany, with many schools, streets, factories, etc., named after them. And many of these names were changed after German reunification, but it's still easy to find streets and the like named after Thalmann in cities like Berlin, Hamburg, and Frankfurt under Oder. And I did experience that myself in Berlin. I just thought that was interesting enough to go through all that.
Sure. Hitler says, "Torgler has been set free. He's peacefully busy with a work on socialism in the 19th century. I'm convinced he was responsible for the burning of the Reichstag, but I can't prove it. Personally, I have nothing against him. Besides, he has completely calmed down. A pity I didn't meet the man 10 years earlier. By nature, he's an intelligent fellow."
See, so now here's another one, Torgler, that he was pretty nice to. And it turns out that this Ernst Torgler, he was the last chairman of the Communist Party of Germany, the last chairman of their faction in the German Reichstag. He was accused by Göring of having something to do with setting the Reichstag fire.
Mm-hmm.
That was in 1933, you know. And
right.
And he voluntarily handed himself over to the police since they had issued a warrant for his arrest. And he was kept in custody until July, and then he was charged with arson and treason, but they didn't find any of these people guilty except that one guy. So he was acquitted due to lack of evidence. But following the Reichstag fire trial, he was placed into protective custody by the police until 1935. In 1938, he was working for the Electrolux company in Germany. And he was being watched by the SD. You know, they had let him out and everything. But in 1941, after Barbarossa, he went to work on anti-Bolshevik propaganda for the Reich at the behest of Joseph Goebbels. I guess they had won him over to some degree, and he also knew Russian. So he was working on this propaganda for the Russian to send into Russia, I guess. And he also worked on the staff of Reinhard Heydrich. So there you go. He was a left winger, but he wasn't of the type of Thalmann.
Well, you know, Carolyn, what this takes me back to, you know, he's talking about these two officials actually in the Communist Party are definite members of the Communist Party. Remember in a previous lesson we had here, we covered Hitler made the remark that some people would be astounded because they think all of our National Socialist people were far right or rightist when 90% of our, it was our new recruits at the time were left. Came out of the Communist Party and joined us. And I think that's one reason why he doesn't real harshly treat these two guys that are mentioned right here.
Well, yeah, he doesn't see them as the worst.
Yeah, because... It was people like them that came over to the National Socialist side when they opened their eyes to the Jewishness of the Red Movement.
Mm-hmm.
That's just my thinking.
Yeah.
Anyway, Hitler says, "That's why it's crazy of Spain to persecute genuine Falangists. Thank God I've always avoided persecuting my enemies." Now, wow, wouldn't these... establishment historians choke on that.
Yes, but that's what he says.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he said it elsewhere, too.
Sure.
Okay, so now that's the end of that long section.
Right.
That was a very interesting one. We've got a couple of shorter ones. So there's a December 30th timeline where you're going to be reading December 29th, but on December 30th. The first Liberty ship, the SS Patrick Henry, is launched by the United States. And these Liberty ships will prove to be a major part of the Allied supply system. Of course, the United States is in the war now, so they can. But, you know, they built a whole bunch of these cargo ships, and they were only built the last 5 years. And they were cheap and easy to build, quick to build, and they came to symbolize U.S. wartime industrial output. And they replaced some of the British ships that had been torpedoed by the German
mm-hmm.
U-boats
mm-hmm.
and all of that. And they, you know, carried a lot of supplies over to the British and to the Soviet Union. And to see here, it says that the United States had 18 American shipyards that built 2,710 of these ships between 1941 and 1945. Mm-hmm. It was the largest number of ships produced to a single design.
That's interesting and good information, too, because those ships began immediately ferrying to England food, military supplies, everything like that.
Right.
Okay, December 29th, 1941, special guests, Dr. Tote and Director General Plieger. The industrialization of the Reich began with the exploitation of the coal in the Ruhr district. Then followed the development of the steel industry with, as a consequence, heavy industry generally, which itself was the origin of the chemical industry and all the others. The main problem today is a problem of labor. Then comes the problem of the basic raw materials, coal and iron. With men, coal and iron, one can solve the transport problem. At this stage, all the conditions are fulfilled for the functioning of a gigantic economy. How can we manage to increase the production of coal and ores? If we employ Russian labor, that will allow us to use our nationals for other tasks. It's better worthwhile to take the trouble of knocking the Russians into shape than to fetch Italians from the south who will say goodbye after 6 weeks. A Russian is not so stupid, after all, that he can't work in a mine. In any case, we're completely geared for standardization. What's more, we'll do less and less turning. Presses will henceforth take the place of lathes. With the help of this colossal human material, I estimate the employable Russian labor at about 2.5 million, we'll succeed in producing the machine tools we need. We can give up the notion of building new factories if we progressively introduce the double shift system. The fact that the night shift doesn't turn out as much as the day shift is not an insuperable inconvenience. The compensation is that we economize on the materials needed for the construction of new factories. One must take long views.
You know, that's short, but it's pretty darn interesting mm-hmm. to me because, well, for a number of reasons. When he talks about the Russians in such a dismissive way, and I don't know if that's right, but sometimes insulting way, or just as though he looks down on them so much, this is a very sensitive part of this book to a lot of people. They don't like it. And he does, he probably, in retrospect, he thought too little of the Russians because as he himself realized, they were capable of a lot more than he thought they were.
Right.
As they started coming on with their offensive and they had all this material and didn't all come from the United States. You know, they had been building all this stuff in the East, manufacturing it. It was this Speer, who I was talking about on Monday, Albert Speer, who said that Hitler depended too much on intelligence information or he didn't know enough about some of these places. You know, Speer might be right about that. He didn't go there himself. He didn't really know about these people, but he formed these opinions about them, and he had a low opinion of the Russians. It came back to bite him pretty badly. But they were dealing with labor now and needing to building armaments, and they needed all this labor, so they were looking at all these Russian POWs they had, 2.5 million to work, and he's just looking at it like a manager, you know, how to get all this done. And Speer said that's what he was doing too. That's how he looked at it. He wasn't thinking about the human lives. He was just thinking about numbers and bodies and workers and so on and all that needed to be accomplished. So it doesn't sound very good, though, to a lot of people who are listening to this or who would be reading it. But I thought I'd just bring that out. But it was necessary. I mean, everybody was doing it. I mean, you couldn't not get done what you needed to get done. You could sue for peace, I guess, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You could turn around and go back. Well.
Okay. We'll move to 30th of December, 1941, midday. Special guest, Himmler. The English are very quick about restoring to seaworthiness those of their ships that have been damaged in the course of operations. This makes one think that they know how to restrict themselves to the indispensable repairs, whilst we insist on finicking about, which loses us precious time. In many fields, we remain faithful to the old habit of always and everywhere achieving the best. I ask you, what good does it do us if a ship we need at one particular moment is made of a steel that outlasts the centuries? Besides, what finally matters in war or peace is that a thing should do the job asked of it at the moment when one needs it. Very often, people cling to the old rules because they're afraid to take a responsibility. And everybody thanks God there's a regulation that removes the opportunity to take the initiative. That's a sort of passive resistance induced by indolence and laziness of the mind. I think there are cases in which faithfulness to the letter of regulation is a sort of sabotage. And that's what we were discussing a bit earlier about responsibility, lack of initiative, et cetera, that he was linking that. And right at the first of that little section where he says, you know, the British seem to know that if they've got a damaged ship, get it in there and repair only what needs to be repaired to get it back in the water and on the line. And don't worry about the, you can't really call it superfluous damage, but stuff that doesn't really play any part in doing the job that that ship is supposed to do. So you don't have to make a perfect ship out of it again, a brand new one. Get it serviceable, fix where it's broken, and send it back out. Yeah. And that's what he's talking about.
Yeah, he's concerning himself with greater efficiency and
yes.
how they're going to get more accomplished because they need to, and what's in the way of their old habits and German perfectionism and so on, and the German pride in the quality and so on. So we don't have to have such high quality and everything. It just has to do the job.
Yeah.
So that's a big thing to get that down through the channels is not easy.
Right. And of all nations that needed the highest level of efficiency they could get, it was Germany because of their precarious situation and fighting against such Goliaths in that fight.
Well, Germans are famous for their efficiency.
That's right.
But also he thought maybe they were in some cases they wanted to have top technical stuff going on. In other cases, they just had to have something. It's not easy. You know, he's saying things here, but, you know, it doesn't mean that he can just turn everything around and make it all work better. Most people were doing the best they could and were listening to what their superiors were saying and trying to carry that out. And so there was other things involved in that.
Sure.
All right, our last little part here.
Okay, the night of 31st December 1941, 1st of January 1942. It would have been possible to hold the Far East if the great countries of white race had joined in a coalition for the purpose. If things had been thus arranged, Japan would never have been able to make her claims prevail. The Japanese have no need of a National Socialist Revolution. If they rid themselves of certain superfluous contributions from the West, they'll avoid the necessity of the social question arising amongst them, whether a Japanese factory belongs to the state or to an individual is purely a formal question. Japan has no great landed class, only small proprietors. The middle class is the backbone of the population. The social question could arise in Japan only if the country acquired enormous wealth. Oshima reckons that we are lucky because the Russian spaces we are conquering have a wild, rough climate. He observes that, on the other hand, the archipelagos on which his compatriots are establishing themselves have a softening climate. If the Dutch were linked with Japan by a commercial agreement, that would have been a clever calculation on their part. Under English pressure, they've done exactly the opposite during the last few years. It's possible the Dutch may decide on such an agreement as soon as Singapore has fallen. Thanks to the Germans, whom the Japanese will employ in the archipelago, we'll have excellent outlets in those regions.
Well, I thought it was very interesting when this Japanese fellow said that what they were conquering, these islands and so on, had a softening effect on their men. And boy, the Japanese, they had a real man-centered society, didn't they? And you know, they created, they did have all these Chinese women and other women where they did conquer to service the sexual demands of the in the bordello type places of their soldiers, because that's what came first in every way. They're criticized for that a lot today, but they shouldn't have forced these foreign women to do it.
Right.
But in any case, they had a very, very tough social order there, male-centered.
Right, right. And I like his speculation here about the Dutch. If they had, you know, if they were linked with Japan by a commercial agreement rather than with England, I think is what he's inferring here, that would have been a clever calculation on their part. And he says, under English pressure, the Dutch have done exactly the opposite during these last few years, which they did. You know, they started joining in on this U.S. demand for boycotting the Japanese raw and keeping them from expanding and getting the raw materials they needed. Well, actually, they were forcing Japan into expansion because they quit. The United States quit trading with Japan on strategic metals and things like this. Well, that island nation had no choice but to look to the closest sources to them, and if those sources were in British hands or in Dutch hands, then they had to go take them if they were going to continue to survive or fight their war. And so what he's saying there, the Dutch should have had a working agreement with the Japanese rather than following the British demands that the Dutch boycott the Japanese as well.
You know, Ray, I was reading not too long ago something somewhere about how badly the British had treated the Dutch, some kind of battles or in different things. I don't know. They weren't nice at all. And I was wondering why the Dutch have always been so wanting to be on the side of the British.
Yes.
And they reject the Germans. And there's it's known that a whole lot of Dutch just hate Germans. Mm-hmm. They don't want to be said that they're they are German.
Right. Racially a whole lot more kin to the German than the Brit.
Mm-hmm. Sure, but they go out of their way. They're always doing whatever the British want them to do, and the British back in history treated them quite badly. I wish I could remember what that was, but it was pretty cut and dried. And I thought, what's wrong with these Dutch people anyway?
Yeah. What they were overwhelmed by the British and their empire building. And to you know, for the Dutch to turn and look at Germany and then take a look at England, that at one time controlled about 17/20 of the Earth's surface and things like this with their empire, and then Germany sitting over there by itself, the Dutch thought, wow, you know. And the Dutch have always been great traders, merchants.
Yeah.
Even back in the 1700s, and they were impressed by the British. The Germans had no huge fleet for dealing across the seas with merchandise and things like this. And so I think that's why they had such an admiration and were in awe of England and thought, well, if we want to copy somebody, let's copy the ones that is hugely successful. You know, so that kind of made sense to me.
I think what the British did to them, to the Dutch, was to do with maybe their fleets or their, you know, the navy and so on, what they took from them or destroyed and wouldn't let them continue with it. They lost a lot of that. I have to go and find that again. But I'm very disappointed in the way the Dutch, the Netherlands, dislikes Germany so much, dislikes Germans.
Yep, I agree. And, you know, I think the British would look at the Dutch and say, you know, we can allow these people to be trading rivals, all right, but only to a certain extent.
Oh,
you know, we're going to let them pick up the table scraps here while we feast on the main entree. So.
Oh, and speaking of that, this just brought this to mind, and I was going to mention this at the beginning of the program, so we still have time. Let me say that I'm going to be having a Saturday show after all this week, but it's going to be tomorrow on Friday. So tomorrow at 2 p.m. Central U.S. time, I'll be doing this interview with Alex Davies, and he's coming into a real busy time, so we had to do it now, and so it's going to be tomorrow. And speaking of that, you know, that just made me think how the British Britain is today. You know, he's head of this started this National Action, pretty radical type of pro-white group in England. Brings to mind the multiracialism, multiculturalism in Britain today, and what a mess it is, and all that they gave up, how far they've come down from this time not all that long ago that you're
good.
Talking about. Yeah.
Good.
Well, any final words?
Yeah,
next
I just
show?
I wanted to remind our listeners to be sure and come back and see us next week, because we start part two of this Table Talk book, and it's some pretty, as usual, fascinating stuff about the origins of the SS, what being in Obersalzberg meant to Hitler and his thinking processes. It's some very good stuff, so be sure and tune in with us next week.
All right, and we will be starting in 1942.
Exactly.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for being with us tonight, and we'll see you next week. Good night.
Good night, all.